We've all been tempted, and maybe you've bought in before. You see a piece of clothing, maybe it's a dress, maybe a snappy pair of pants. Either way, the item is priced to move. At $15, $10, who wouldn't buy it, right? That's the kind of low price that's both unbelievable and in a lot of ways come to be expected. You might wonder, how could that cotton have been grown, harvested, and woven into yarn, dyed, and shipped across the world, and then sewn into clothes by someone else and shipped back across the world, all for only $15 out of your pocket? Who really pays for this kind of fashion? The answer is always somebody, somewhere. If that bothers you and you still care about fashion, enter three little letters that we're getting pretty used to seeing as a prefix. Eco. Eco-friendly, eco-fashion, eco-ethics, eco-hotels, eco-this, and eco-that. Think of natural, think green, environmentally friendly, sustainable. But what do all these words actually mean when applied to the fashion industry, to the shampoos and conditioners in our bathrooms, to the deodorant under our arms? Our guest today can help us sort those out. She's researched the morally unconscionable side of fashion, and she still believes that consumers have the power to change these things, if only they knew about them and made more informed choices. Her new book on the topic began as a blog back in 2008, and we don't know of any other fashion books that open with a quote from Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, the text that pretty much jump-started the environmental movement 50 years ago. We do know Magnifico isn't your typical shopping guide. Yeah, it recommends certain brands over others, but mostly it shines a light in our bathrooms and in our closets to help us see what we are buying into and what we aren't. The author is Kate Black, founder and editor-in-chief of Magnifico.com. Kate Black joins us now on the line to talk about green fashion. Kate, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, good morning, Emily. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So in looking at this book and looking at your blog, Magnifico.com, it seems like with the book, you might run the risk of preaching to the choir. Do you have a specific audience in mind?
It's actually, I don't know if I'm preaching to the choir. When I had the blog, Magnifico.com, it was always just highlighting the good news, the designers who are doing things better, the makers who are making products, kind of using innovation instead of traditional methods. And then I just, over time, I started to realize that people maybe didn't realize the why and why people were going out of their way and why these new things were popping on the marketplace. So this book is to kind of wake everybody up. I think most people have heard some of these things, but time and time again, I meet people who are like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that, you know, children were still involved in the jewelry business. And oh my gosh, I didn't know that, you know, conventional cotton is still 99% of all cotton. So I think it's a little bit of a wake-up call for everybody.
It certainly was for me in reading it. I mean, a lot of times I've heard the term greenwashing, you know, when we kind of apply a label but maybe don't really know what it means. I was surprised to learn in your book that the cosmetic provisions from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, they've only been changed three times since 1938, and only 11 ingredients have been banned in all those years. What kind of consequences to human health did you discover from these lax regulations?
Well, I think one of the issues is, you know, we recognize that families are going through things that our parents didn't go through. You know, we have a lot more child illnesses. Autism is on the rise. Eczema is on the rise. Like, we're just seeing all of these incidents of kind of poor health or issues that we're having to deal with, and nobody can really figure out why. And so we're starting to understand that our food and what we put in our mouth has a direct impact on our health. But I wanted people to realize that it's also what we put on our skin and bring into our home. So I wanted, particularly around personal care products, because, you know, men can use up to 5, and that's like your shampoo, your conditioner, your toothpaste, your shaving cream, your deodorant, that's 5 already. And if you're using anything more, that's more. And it's up to, for men, it's over 60 different chemicals every day, and women they think is double that. So 12 products, over 168 different chemicals, and most of them have not been tested for safety. And I think we think, well, it's on the shelf, it must be safe. And I wanted people to just kind of recognize that's not the case. That's not the criteria. If safety is important to you, you need to take ownership of that.
So what does it take to get banned by the FDA if you're a beauty or a hygiene product?
I don't know, because Canada has a list. So the U.S. has a list of 11. Canada has a list of 600, and the EU has a list of 1,300. So what we're seeing is different countries and different policymakers have different priorities, and conventional brands are appealing to that. So you could see a brand on the shelf here, and if it's made for the Canadian market, which a lot of brands are multinational, it'll be a cleaner brand or a cleaner formula. And if it's made for the European market, an even cleaner formula. So the question is, like, why aren't we getting the same kind of, if the EU has decided that those 1,300 chemicals are possibly unsafe, questionable for safety, you know, better off not used, then why aren't we just all following suit? And I don't know the answer to that. I know people are lobbying. I know people are working to campaign for safer cosmetics, but I don't know if we're going to see an outcome.
So if the FDA, if the U.S. government is not looking out for consumers in the market for cosmetics and beauty products, who is?
I think it's up to us. So I think it's important for us to start being a little bit more mindful about the things that we're buying and really kind of thinking about, okay, do I trust this brand? Do I trust the ingredients on the list? Do I think that I need to even use it? Like, I think a lot of personal care products we throw in our cart or in our basket, we're just like, oh, okay, well, sure, I'll try a hand cream and a body lotion and a foot cream. Like, so I think we're also adding to our kind of our chemical load in ways that maybe if we were just a little bit more mindful, we might not.
We're talking with Kate Black. She is the founder and editor-in-chief of Magnifico.com. Her book of the same name has just come out in paperback. You are welcome to join this conversation about green fashion and what is in our beauty products. 800-838-3760 is the number, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Kate, we're just talking about 11 products banned by the United States FDA versus some 1,300 ingredients for cosmetics that have been prohibited in the European Union. Why do you think the beauty industry has moved away from plant-based products and some of the alternatives that you lay out in Magnifico?
Everyone that I spoke to said it was really about price, that synthetics are cheaper, and the synthetics that we use in American formulations are cheaper than their alternatives or safer alternatives for the Canadian market or for the European market. So it means that we're kind of really supporting companies who have, you know, bottom line pricing as their motivation and not our health.
So how do we tell the bad actors from the good when we go to the aisle with, you know, thousands of bottles on it and we just want some shampoo or something?
I think the easiest way is to not buy them in the usual places. So if you think about all the marketing that it takes and all the money that it takes to get shelf placement either at the drugstore or at the grocery store, I think what you're looking for is a brand that doesn't have that kind of marketing power. And so maybe the natural food store, the health food store, you know, trying to step away from the conventional places where you're going to find the conventional brands. Most non-toxic beauty brands just don't sell there.
Very, very interesting. And I want to move on to clothing. A big part of your book, Magnifico. Kind of a big question here. We talk about fair trade a lot. What does it mean, and is there a staple for what it means when it comes to clothing?
So fair trade is interesting because we know it from bananas, we know it from coffee, and that's usually because there's a single source. When it comes to clothing, it's a little bit more complicated because clothing has so many steps. You know, we have the grower of the cotton or the natural material, then we have the spinning, the cut and sew, the dyeing. So there's several different steps, and in order to be fully certified fair trade, every step along the journey needs to be certified. The World Fair Trade Organization is working on that. So there are 10 brands within their pilot project, and two have already graduated. So there's two World Federation Fair Trade brands. One is a hat brand out of the UK, and another one is an organic clothing brand also out of the UK. So I think we'll see that more often. But what's also kind of coming up and rising through the ranks is Fair Trade certified factories. So Fairtrade USA is certifying, they've certified a shoe factory in Ethiopia for a Canadian brand called Au Liberté. They've certified a basic cotton factory for a brand in your neck of the woods called Pact Apparel. So all the basics, T-shirts, underwear, everything else comes from Fairtrade cotton and then a Fairtrade certified factory.
Well, let's talk about cotton for a minute. How does conventional cotton differ from organic or Fairtrade cotton?
So fair trade cotton means that the producers were paid a living wage. So, and that could be conventional cotton. So there's two different issues. Are we talking about money? Or are we talking about kind of land safety and kind of the organic health of the cotton? And there's a middle step in there. So there's conventional, there's what's called sustainable, and then there's organic. And so sustainable is really trying to pull back from conventional, really trying to get farmers to think about alternative measures or methods of pest management instead of going straight to insecticides and straight to pesticides, because I think a lot of, similar to what we were just talking about with our personal care products, I think we've gotten to a stage where some smallholder farmers are just being told, okay, just use more chemicals, just don't think about it. And so we're getting this kind of chemically laden cotton, and the sustainable cotton groups, their NGOs in Africa and India, are working with farmers to really think about whether or not they need to use all of those chemicals. And then organic cotton is exactly like it is in food. There's just really no chemicals involved. The yield is smaller, and right now it's only 1% of the entire cotton growth. So we want it as consumers, but we're not demanding enough because we're not getting more support to farmers to switch and transition over to organic cotton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an interesting example in your book, Magnifico, about an article of organic cotton clothing. I think it's a tank top or something by Eileen Fisher that's labeled made in the USA. But in actuality, it needs to travel across 3 countries, 2 continents, and 17,000 miles before it makes its way to the New Jersey warehouse. But you're saying in an organic process, would that have been certified at each step of the way, or that's only fair trade?
That's only fair trade.
Uh-huh.
So for organic certification, that's when we would have GOTS certification. So, and this is not really as common in the U.S. as it is in the EU or other countries. And so GOTS certification says that the plant was organic when it came into the process, and then it stayed organic. So the dyes and the finishings and everything else that were used on the product along the way are also just as clean as the cotton. So it's a great kind of partnership certification for organic cotton. So it's my favorite for underwear or kids' clothes or anything. Organic cotton that's also GOTS certified.
And are synthetic fabrics inherently bad actors on the environmental side of these considerations?
Yes. I mean, it depends what we're looking at. Like, the reason why the book starts with Rachel Carson is because clothes actually are laden with a lot of chemicals as well, even if they start off with a natural fiber. Like, it takes a lot of chemicals to grow the conventional cotton and then to process it along the way. And so synthetics start off with other elements, but we're kind of in the same boat. Like, they're both chemically laden processes to make natural resources or unnatural resources into clothing.
I want to talk about the jewelry chapter as well. Thinking about gold, it's pretty much synonymous with both wealth and a lot of suffering. Why are we still so into it one way? And, you know, is eco-gold a total oxymoron? Are there certain things, especially in jewelry, that are just, you just can't have them and feel good about it?
It's a challenge, and so I couldn't write the book. The book is it's called A Head-to-Toe Guide, because I thought, you know what, we can't really open up these cans of worms and talk about these issues without talking about jewelry. Jewelry is super chemical laden to get it out of the land, and we just don't need to do that. I mean, we're using it not just for jewelry; we're also using it for industrial uses. It's one of the metals that we're using in technology. So we have this need for it, but we also have this mass abundance that has already been mined. So I think when we're looking for jewelry, so fair trade certified silver and gold has started the process. And again, this means that the mines and the miners have been certified fair trade, and the product that you're getting has adhered to those kind of 10 fair trade principles, which includes no child labor, fair pricing, environmental overview. Like, the fair trade principles are really, I think, what we all have at our core when we're thinking about how to do things right in the world. So there is fair trade gold and fair trade silver. And then a lot of kind of my favorite jewelers, or the ones that I recommended in the book, are using recycled. Because there's so much already existing, there's no reason to go out and seek new and be curious about the origins of it or what kind of history it's coming with when they could just use recycled.
Why do you single out pearls as a more earth and socially friendly alternative in jewelry?
I like the Sustainable Pearl initiative because we know that the waters are in trouble. We know that the coral reefs are in trouble. And sustainable pearl farmers are actually kind of, they're also the guardians of the coral and the reef. So when you're buying a sustainable pearl, you're also actually supporting these guardians of the sea. So I like that this is something that is a good product for you to have or a good token of your love, but it's also kind of creating livelihoods and opportunities for people to keep living near the land and keep paying attention to these things that we want to protect.
Your chapter about clothes made with animal products also circles back to this issue of, you know, people who are either stewards of the land or, you know, have been practicing animal husbandry for many, many generations, and it's their livelihood. These freedoms of animals that you lay out, they sound really nice if we could apply them to every living thing on Earth. You know, freedom from suffering, freedom to behave normally. There's, I think, three others there. How is something kind of so noble and broad in its intent, how can that be told in a label or verified?
Again, it's a really hard thing. It's similar to fair trade. We don't necessarily have a label yet for the ethical use of animals, but I think if you know a farmer, you know that there's people who are really passionate about living off the land and taking care of their animals, and some of those animals, whether it's sheep for wool, whether it's alpaca for alpaca, or whether it's mink farms, like there are people who are doing it well, and then we have this whole other side where it's just about consumption and mass production. And so I think one of the things I wanted the book to do was just kind of give an overview into what these systems could look like if they were done thoughtfully, and then what we should be looking for as consumers to support the thoughtful makers or the thoughtful creators.
We've been talking with Kate Black, author of Magnifico, your head-to-toe guide to ethical fashion and non-toxic beauty. Kate, thanks so much for being on The Exchange with us this morning.
Emily, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, take care.